From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Annie Ropeek in for Laura Knoy on this Earth Day, and this is The Exchange. We have the Environmental Brain Trust with us today, a roundtable of environment reporters who've spent their time looking into the latest developments in fighting climate change from around New England. We'll be discussing innovations and signs of progress in fighting climate change, and we'll hear what they're seeing in their states. We don't want to paint a falsely optimistic picture. We are in a climate crisis. But we do want to take a moment to acknowledge some positives and some movement toward change. We'd love to hear from you, too. Let us know about any signs you've noticed in your travels, maybe dream projects from other states, promising research, questions you have about policies from other states that maybe New Hampshire should adopt. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call at 800-892-6477. Joining us now, I'm so excited to have this roundtable of all of my favorite colleagues from around the region. First, we have Daniela Ali, NHPR's Western New Hampshire reporter. Hi, Daniela.
Hey, Annie.
And we have John Dillon, Vermont Public Radio reporter. Hi, John.
Hello, Annie. Hi, everybody.
And then also with us, Patrick Scahill, reporter at WNPR in Connecticut.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And lastly, Eve Zukoff, the climate and environment reporter at WCAI on Cape Cod and a Report for America fellow. Good morning, Eve.
Hi there, Annie.
And we'll hear from one of our colleagues in Maine a little later. I'm Annie Ropeek. I'm also of NHPR, and I lead our By Degrees climate reporting project. We've had a ton of great stories from this whole group this whole week as part of the New England News Collaborative's work with Covering Climate Now, a global journalism partnership. You can see all our reporting at nenc.news. We're going to talk about energy in this part of our show. We'll get to oceans and some other science, trash, transportation, other policy issues all a little later on. And we welcome your thoughts and questions about how New England is doing in addressing climate change. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on our Facebook page or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, all one word, or call us 1-800-892-6477. First things first, we all know that renewable energy transitions are well underway in all of our states, some more than others. I'd like to get a quick sense from all of you on how far along our states are in adopting new forms of energy. Let's see, John, let's start with you. How is Vermont doing on its renewable push?
Well, on paper, Vermont's doing really well. And it's actually kind of an interesting debate and issue that's just kind of resurfacing now, because we count, the state of Vermont counts as renewable, already built projects and imported renewable energy, primarily from Hydro-Quebec. So we get a lot, I think roughly 40% of our power mix is from Quebec. 30%, 44% of our renewable mix is from Quebec, but 30% of our overall. So that's considered a big part of what's called tier one renewable. And so the new renewables, your solar, your wind is kind of stalled in Vermont.
Right, because it's all onshore, right? You don't have any offshore wind in Vermont.
No, unless you want to put it in Lake Champlain. It's been ridgeline wind, and because change in governors and change in policy and a lot of local opposition, there hasn't been a large wind project built here in a number of years. Solar is doing well, but I would say the bloom is off a little bit of that because there's pushback from regulators about the cost that is paid out for net metered projects, for example, and the cost shift that utilities, because they're paying substantially higher prices for local solar than they would for other energy sources. So they're arguing there's a cost shift to other customers who don't use solar. So there's a sort of regulatory pushback. The State Public Utility Commission just reset those rates and notched them down a little bit. But this renewable in hand, so to speak, large-scale hydro means that we really do, if you want to count that as pure renewable, we really do have one of the cleanest grids in the region, if not the cleanest.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, the proximity to Hydro-Québec, and that's been a big part of the conversation in increasing renewables across the region's grid. I know that we've had a lot of similar pushback on small-scale solar, net metering. That debate is, ongoing in New Hampshire. Danielle, let's turn to you quickly. We know New Hampshire has sort of one of the lowest or least aggressive renewable goals in the region, but where are we at in renewable adoption here in the Granite State?
Right, Annie. Well, as you've been reporting, there is a push towards having a bill in the Senate that would spur, major offshore wind development that, could be pretty significant for New Hampshire. As you said, a couple of other things around solar and net metering, that's still in contention. And but there are also, a separate Senate bill that could, allow producer or generators of 1 to 5 megawatts of energy to sell that locally without having to pay for out-of-state transmission costs. And so that would change could change and spur more local development. That's currently in the House Science and Technology Committee that just had a hearing on Monday. So I think there's some movement there, but as you said, New Hampshire lags behind the other New England states.
Sure. And then so we've heard that Vermont is, already well on its way. There's a 75% renewable adoption goal in Vermont by 2032. New Hampshire's renewable goal is 25% by 2025. And then Connecticut, Rhode Island are both in the 30s and 40s for that goal. Patrick, let's go to you. What does renewable adoption look like in Connecticut right now?
Here in Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont, he's called for the state to achieve a 100% zero carbon electric supply by 2040. Pretty aggressive goal there. The proposal is to sort of phase that in at least 45% below the 2001 emission levels by 2030, and then hit that 100% zero carbon mark by 2040. And this is actually building off of an executive order that Lamont had put out in 2019, and there's now some legislation to enact this order. And the state has said, Annie, that while this is an aggressive target, it is one that is achievable. Right now, the state is saying that about 65% of the electricity that the two major suppliers here, United Illuminating and Eversource, the electricity that they put out, 65% of that is from renewables and nuclear, which is important to mention because nuclear is such a huge part of our generation mix here in Connecticut from the Millstone Power Station.
That's right, and that's one of two nuclear plants left in the region. The other, of course, is Seabrook up here in New Hampshire. And yeah, I mean, we do get. I think it's about a third all the time of our power in the region from just those two nuclear plants, which is kind of astonishing if you think about just the amount of energy that that means. Of course, the rest or the other majority is from natural gas, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But I wanted to finish on Massachusetts. The goal there is 80% renewable use by 2050. Eve, how is Mass doing on making it to that goal?
Well, as far as goals, Massachusetts is a national leader. But in practice, about a quarter of the state's net generation was produced by renewable sources in recent years. Most of that is from solar power, which actually does make the state nationally rank really high on solar production. But by mid-2020, the state had two dozen or so utility scale wind power facilities online. So wind power accounted for like 1% of the state's net generation. Of course, I know we'll talk a lot more about offshore wind, which is going to completely change the conversation around this, or there are a lot more goals. But then just I would just throw in on a local scale, there are a lot of interesting projects all over the region to be even more aggressive than what the state is doing. So on Martha's Vineyard, the island is looking for a way to be 100% powered by 100% renewables by 2040 because they're an island and they can kind of find interesting ways to do that. So those are kind of interesting projects within the scope of what the state is looking at.
Oh, that is super interesting. And I do want to talk more about these sort of local pushes for more energy independence, more renewable energy on the local level in a second. I do just want to mention on the state of fossil fuels in the region, we are pretty close to having only one coal plant left in New England. That's Merrimack Station. It's right down the road from NHPR Studios in Bow. The other coal plant left is in Connecticut. It's going to retire in June. It's already been replaced with a natural gas plant. Overall, we just don't use coal nearly as much as we used to, though it is not completely gone. 20 years ago, New England got about a fifth of its power from coal. Now it's about 1%. But like we said, imported natural gas is still our main source of electricity as a region. It's on the rise for heating, too. Patrick, you and our colleague JD Allen at WSHU have been reporting this week on Connecticut's debate over a proposed gas plant in the town of Killingly. Tell us about that project, and I hear it has ties to the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota.
That's right. JD Allen from WSHU has been doing some really great reporting, sort of exploring kind of the intricacies of natural gas pipeline connections and sort of how that debate has framed up here in Connecticut. And it's been really awkward, I will say. And it's awkward from the standpoint of Governor Ned Lamont, having these aggressive zero carbon goals. While at the same time, the state's kind of moving along on some natural gas projects, and the Killingly project really is a great example of that. To I guess pick off your last question there, yes, the plant in Killingly does have ties to Line 3, and Line 3 is a Annie. I'm sure, and everyone else on this call knows more about this than I do, but
Just give it the
I will
give us
just
the
brief.
basics. Yeah.
I will briefly give the basics. So this is a 1,000-mile pipeline, which is being upgraded right now by a company called Enbridge. It would be carrying tar sands oil from Canada across indigenous land in Minnesota to a crude oil transportation hub on Lake Superior. But Enbridge, the company that's working to upgrade that pipeline, also recently finished something called the Atlantic Bridge Project, which started in 2017 in New England. And now pumps natural gas through, let's see, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and I believe Maine as well. So here in Connecticut, sort of in the northeast portion of our state, there's this town called Killingly. Killingly also already has a natural gas plant, but they're proposing to build another one there. One of the reasons is it actually is, at a fairly good location where it could tie into that Atlantic Bridge Project pipeline. So that is in the process of happening right now. Again, it's put the state in this sort of awkward position where the state is kind of blaming regional energy market structures for kind of bringing this plant to the fore in the first place, while simultaneously saying, well, we don't really want it, but it's probably going to get built. But again, we don't really want it. So it's been a very awkward story.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I mean, the idea of this debate and question over whether natural gas is a bridge fuel or what that even means, if you can have sort of strong climate action and still facilitate new natural gas growth is a huge question in the region. We saw that activists in New Hampshire, came out against a proposed pipeline from Liberty Utilities, that Liberty did pull that project. They are still going to expand gas service. They just found another way to do it. So I agree that the gas fight is a really complicated one. It's interesting that we're talking about all of this as signs of progress. I want to note that, emissions from energy generation are way down in the region. It's sort of been the easiest thing, it seems like, to fix, whereas things like transportation and, residential heating uses are still pretty stagnant or just a lot harder to decarbonize, and we'll talk about that. John, you want to weigh in?
Well, the debate over natural gas is fascinating, both for Vermont and the region. We've had a pipeline here that's been very controversial, and was seen as a potential route for natural gas south. But it underscores that natural gas generation is sort of the backstop for all of the renewables we've been talking about, the spinning reserve that the grid needs to maintain reliability is often reliant on natural gas generators. So with the solar build-out and with the wind, when that stuff is not producing, and with solar, it's at night, then natural gas is the backup. And so I don't know how we as a region get away from that without some, you know, huge game-changing technology of battery storage. It's just, it's what we're dealt with our grid.
Yeah, for sure. And we had another great story from JD Allen, who's really my MVP of Earth Week, on battery storage. And, you know, I think that's expected to have huge growth in the coming years, but it's only right at the beginning. So I did want to turn to offshore wind just quickly here, you know, because that's arguably a big solution for like new baseload power, although renewables, you know, kind of pose a different figure than just a power plant you can switch on. You know, you do have to rely on the natural resource, but like you're saying, John, if you pair that with battery storage, that can potentially be a sort of always on source of power. We know the Biden administration wants to build 30 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030, which would be like 25 new Seabrook nuclear power plants. A lot of that could go in New England waters. We already have the first utility scale wind farm right now in Block Island Sound off Rhode Island. And of course, Massachusetts and the Gulf of Maine are sort of seen as the next frontiers for wind. The feds are supposed to approve Vineyard Wind off Martha's Vineyard any day now. Eve, what can you tell us about that project and just what's going on in southern New England for offshore wind?
Yeah, so right, the cleaner sister to natural gas, right? So as you say, this offshore wind project is awaiting federal approval. And if Vineyard Wind comes online, it will be able to power over 400,000 homes in Massachusetts. A little bit of equivalence here. That would eliminate basically like getting 365,000 gas-powered cars off of the road. It could create 3,600 jobs, especially in New Bedford, which is a really hardworking South Coast community. There could be a big, very needed boost there because Vineyard Wind is planning to lease the New Bedford Marine Commerce Terminal, which is the only one of its kind in the country, for at least 18 months as kind of a primary staging facility. But as a reminder, the Mass Clean Energy Center built this terminal, which is the size of 22 football fields, back when Cape Wind was still a thing. Mm-hmm. So that was betting big on offshore wind then. And, you know, as we talk about this, should be clear, that did not work out. That was a big bet, and Cape Wind did not get off the ground. It fizzled out. But now where we stand today is that any day now, the Interior Department will approve, deny, or suggest changes to Vineyard Wind's construction plan. And that ruling represents the last big obstacle that the project needs to overcome before construction can begin. And then the company would be able to do two kind of unfathomably big things. It would be able to, first of all, likely deliver power by the end of 2023, and also pave the way for a massive offshore wind industry up and down the coast. So that's really what we're waiting on. That could come any day now, that approval. And it looks likely at this point.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say you mentioned Cape Wind and just the long saga that it's been to get this going. I remember I my first job was on Cape Cod, not in public radio, but I reported on, you know, efforts to get that New Bedford terminal started up back in like 2013. And it just continues, you know, and the offshore wind permitting process for the Gulf of Maine is 10 years long, but, you know, it's right. High risk, high reward, I suppose. I want to just put a pin in the local energy discussion. Let's talk about that in our next segment, because I want to spend a little more time on these sort of bigger power sources. Patrick, did you want to say something else about natural gas?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that money is obviously a big part of all of these conversations as well. And, you know, there on the one hand, there are the aggressive goals that a state could put forth for, you know, zero carbon emissions and things like that. But the way that regional energy markets are structured right now are heavily weighted towards what's the cheapest source of power available at a time. And I think to John's earlier point about, you know, natural gas being the backstop fuel right now, it's cheap, you know, and that goes very far in getting some of these projects the approvals they need to go forward. And that has, you know, going back to the earlier stuff we were saying about Killingly, played a big role here. The Killingly plant priced in a way that, you know, made it competitive. And I just think, you know, money is something to think about when we have these discussions as well.
That's right. So before we take a quick break, I wanted to get in a couple of our listener comments. We had an email from Catherine. She writes, thank you for covering climate change solutions today. I'm a 12th grader at the Derryfield School who loves Nordic skiing, and climate action is very important to me to have a safe future. A climate solution I'm particularly excited about is the Energy Innovation Act, a bill in the U.S. Congress that uses cashback carbon pricing to direct us toward a path of reaching net zero emissions by 2030, create local jobs, help the poor, and save lives. I'd like to encourage all your listeners to write to President Biden and our congressional delegation in support of the Energy Innovation Act. And we also have a voicemail from another young activist. Let's hear from Jordan, that is looking at more bills in Congress that give young activists hope.
My name is Jordan, and I'm a senior in high school in Milford, New Hampshire. Something that is exciting to me has been the new Green New Deal bills introduced into Congress. There have been three so far: the Green New Deal for cities, the Green New Deal for public housing, and Ed Markey and AOC have reintroduced the General Green New Deal. This is the first time it's been introduced in a Congress and presidency that are fully Democratic, so I'm really hopeful that there is a chance these groundbreaking climate policies will pass and we'll be able to look forward to the major changes it's going to make to create a livable future for my generation and generations to come. Because I'm young and had to face things like a global pandemic already, I am really worried about all the crises our country is facing. These are things that young people shouldn't have to worry about, but we have. So it is really hopeful for me to see bills that are addressing both climate change as well as things like economic inequality, racial inequality, and addressing the effects of COVID-19.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Annie Ropeek, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Happy Earth Day. We're here with environment reporters from around New England, and we are joined by one more for this part of our show. Fred Bever from Maine Public is here. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Annie.
So I want to just finish one thing from our first part of our conversation. This is my dream roundtable where we have way more to talk about than we could possibly fit into an hour. But I wanted to talk about community power and local independent energy solutions. Daniela, this has been making waves in New Hampshire recently. You've been covering it. What do we mean when we say community power?
Yeah, so community power allows municipalities and counties to purchase power in bulk, basically on behalf of residents and businesses through opt-out programs. So a lot of advocates in municipalities here in the state say, hey, being able to have these kinds of programs will allow us to purchase more renewable energy and perhaps at more competitive costs to ratepayers. So basically the way that works is that the towns and cities and even counties, they would be working, working with this coalition called the Community Power Coalition of New Hampshire that would have staff that would kind of be the ones managing those energy contracts. But I think the big thing to highlight here is that the utility would still be the one to distribute that energy. So it's not going to, oh, it's just your town now managing the poles and wires here. So that's been a pretty big deal in the last year. It was a bill that was signed in 2019 by Governor Sununu, actually. And in the past couple of months, we've seen this kind of come to the forefront because of a bill in the House that at first, you know, kind of advocates said really challenged the current structure that the 2019 law put out for community power, and that the 2021 bill would have really hampered what they wanted to see done. You know, I think a lot of advocates envision having like time of use rates, battery storage, a number of, you know, much more advanced things that they could include within these kinds of programs that this bill would have originally perhaps really restricted. But there was a big compromise that happened, and a compromise that advocates, utilities, and, you know, the state representatives were pretty pleased with, that, you know, I think everyone felt was a win-win-win. So yeah, I think, you know, and kind of maybe as we're talking about here, I think it's really interesting in New Hampshire to see a lot of these smaller towns, you know, kind of banding together to figure out how to do this, because and figuring out solutions at a local level, while things are still being figured out, perhaps at the state level.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, Fred, let's go to you in Maine. What does the local energy world look like up there?
Well, when you talk about community power here, in the last 2 years, that's really come to mean solar projects of 5 megawatts or less. Mm-hmm. That's because solar was pretty suppressed here in the state during the administration of Republican Governor Paula Page. And since then, Governor Janet Mills, a Democrat in a democratically controlled legislature, has gotten very aggressive in providing a grab bag of incentives to try to build out renewable energy. One in particular that they did was expand what John Dillon was talking about earlier, net energy billing credits for solar development at 5 megawatts or lower, which is what we're calling here a community scale. And many of the projects that have been proposed within that are people banding together in a town or just with neighbors, or even, you know, a small company, and putting solar on a landfill and all getting the benefit of that. Because of what the legislature did, there were around two, there were something like two of these 2 years ago proposed at this scale. There are now more than 600 proposed, some of them being developed now. The entire capacity, if all of those were they built out, would be more than the entire consumption of the state right now. Now, this is, of course, creating similar problems to what John Dillon was talking about. There's a subsidy involved that all ratepayers pay. That's what makes it very attractive to the developers and to the people they're trying to develop the energy source for. And now the Public Utilities Commission is coming with a study saying if all of these happen, this could cost Maine consumers more than $100 million a year because of the subsidy that goes to the ones who are getting the direct benefit from those solar projects. So now there's a possible moratorium, particularly on 3 to 5 megawatt projects being considered by the legislature. We'll see how fast it actually gets built out. Also, there are questions about just having the infrastructure to get all of that new energy, intermittent renewable energy onto the grid. And I just want to add one more thing in terms of success stories around solar, though. At the same time as this project sort of was so successful that now the legislature has to consider cranking it back, there's another one that was very successful, which was just having our State Utilities Commission make a procurement of renewable energy, asked for bids for more than 500 megawatts of energy. What they got was a lot of bigger solar scale solar projects, bigger than 5 megawatts, bidding in at between 3 cents and 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow, which is not very much.
That's very cheap. And so now you also see in the legislature moves to do some more procurements of that nature at that scale. There's a fight going on. Big energy users want those. They want the big procurements. Local people want to be able to have incentives, more expensive incentives, to do local projects, which do have some other benefits besides price for the grid, right? They take pressure off of the grid by having lots of smaller local sources. So that's sort of where the big debate on the good news of renewable power is here in Maine.
Sure. I mean, and we really could talk about energy for about 100 years on this show, but I want to move on to our oceans, which we know the Gulf of Maine is one of the fastest warming parts of the country. And Fred, you as well as Eve down there on the Cape have been reporting a lot on one sort of aspect of the ocean warming story, which is the endangered North Atlantic right whale. So, Fred, remind us what the situation with these whales has to do with climate change.
Well, it gets down to the food chain, really. There are about 300 North Atlantic right whales left on the planet, and they are following their, one scientist actually down in Eve's neck of the woods at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute called them the true climate change refugees. Mm. Their food source, which is a tiny little crustacean called Calanus finmarchicus, it's their favorite one, its abundance is changing in response to changes in the warmth of the Gulf of Maine and other waters. And so that's why where they used to have a lot of presence up off of the Gulf of Maine and towards the Bay of Fundy off the state of Maine in the Canadian provinces, now like there's this abundance down in the Cape, and it's scientists think this is very much climate driven. So there's that relationship in terms of the push for ocean wind, I guess, could help with climate change. But as I said, they're really climate refugees. Now, Eve has been out there observing the whales in their native habitat. So you really want to hear from her about what's going on there.
Yeah, sure thing. Eve, you have been doing some really cool stories on this. I want to hear about ropeless lobster fishing technology you've been reporting on, and just like tell us what it was like to get up close and personal with one of these whales, which you did the other day, I think.
Yes, that's right. So really quickly, the basics of ropeless fishing are basically that the way fishing works right now, lobster fishing works right now, is that on the sea floor, you have a trap. It looks like a big kind of dog cage, if you will. And then there's a rope going up to the surface where there's a buoy. And that's how lobstermen traditionally find where they set their traps. Now, what ropeless fishing seeks to do is eliminate that buoy and rope from the water, because those ropes are the ones that are primarily entangling right whales. There are other things that entangle right whales too, most likely, but that's a huge contributor. So what ropeless fishing does is it gets rid of that rope, gets rid of that buoy, and from their boat, what fishermen can do is they, on an app on their phones, the way I saw it work on a boat in Cape Cod Bay, you hit a button on your phone and the trap on the seafloor has an inflatable bag inside of it. An air tank fills up that bag and the trap shoots up to the surface. And then behind it are a number of other traps connected through what's called a ground line. It's not a vertical line in the water that entangles whales. It's the ground line that doesn't really entangle them. So that's kind of how it works in theory. The problem is that right now, ropeless is completely tied up in a number of hurdles. There are a lot of questions about whether it's safe right now, because if you get rid of those buoys and fishermen can't see what's on the seafloor, then you need an adjoining app that shows you, okay, well, all the other fishermen in the area, here's where they set their traps on the seafloor. We have it geolocation, geomarked that way. But right now there's no app that can really do that well across different brands of different ropeless technology. And that's a serious safety concern, because if a dragger, a fisherman that drags a net across the bottom of the seafloor, scoops up some of these traps, they can be heavy enough that it could flip their boats over. You can lay traps on top of one another. There's real safety implications there. It's also, frankly, not cost effective right now. One Woods Hole scientist told me he's looking, he basically spends nights and weekends looking for funding sources for ways to make ropeless more cost effective. It could cost like $70,000 for a single fisherman to convert his gear. And that's just because it's being built in such small doses. And then I'd say the final hurdle is that it's really hard to find a fisherman who sees ropeless fishing favorably. The Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association is not in favor of this technology. Fred, I bet you can speak to how the Maine Lobstermen's Association feels. I bet it's the same.
You won't find a single lobsterman here trying to use ropeless. And in fact, the state itself, the marine regulators are also against it. Because they see it as completely impractical for the varied bottom terrain that we have in the state of Maine. They see it as an existential threat, really, this whole idea.
Yeah.
And I do want to throw in that within a month, we're going to see new regulations from the federal government that aim to protect the whales. And it will likely mean a lot of new restrictions on these fishing industries that depend on rope to do it, because the rope poses a real danger to the whales. And there's going to be a real interesting shakeout coming between the fishing industries and the conservationists and the regulators on how to protect whales.
And the way Massachusetts is trying to get ahead of that is they are launching a 12-month ropeless fishing feasibility study to see if You know, can we figure out if there is a way, economically, technically, safety-wise, to remove that rope from the water, save the fishing industry, save the whales? And having gone out and seen them, I mean, it is an experience I will never forget. I mean, I can't underscore enough how fraught this whole conversation is. Like, there's real fear, there's real dire importance to save the fishing industry. And yet when you're on that boat, there is this moment where you see this whale come up, and I'm speechless. I'm a radio reporter who does not have the words to explain what it feels like. I mean, it blew me away. I'd never seen anything like that. And capturing the sound of a right whale, the sound of the blowhole puffing up this air on a microphone is like, I no one told me in journalism school that I would be able to do that one day. And it was just really, that was a very cool experience for me.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's a great story. I think there is a link to it, or should be a link to it, on our website. So much of what we're talking about, you know, gets at like the individual people and the individual like policy conflicts that sort of stand in the way or could facilitate, you know, large scale change on these large, really important issues. I mean, I was thinking about the natural gas conversation. Like, that's so much thornier than, you know, everyone wishes that it would be. And the same for, we got an email about things like biomass, wood powered energy, which we've done whole shows about. And the same about the, you know, fight to save sort of one of our signature, or like signal species, you know, if you will, which is the right whale. Just before we take another break, I wanted to let Fred talk a little bit about an interesting little innovative project in Maine on carbon sequestration in kelp, in farmed kelp. Fred, what's going on with this?
Okay, so this gets to the sort of the geoengineering scale of trying to not only reduce carbon dioxide emissions, but actually take them back, right? The 200 years of since the Industrial Revolution has put in all this extra carbon dioxide in the air, and there are now efforts to try to stuff some of it back underground or into the water. there are important arguments about whether this is just a really dangerous idea, first of all, because you're talking about continuing to try to manipulate the planet's environment more. And secondly, because you could be giving corporations an excuse just to keep on polluting because, hey, there's a techno fix.
We know that companies like Exxon even just recently have really come out in favor of carbon sequestration and storage as a solution.
They've got a big money-making, capital-intensive methodology to try to do that, but they need a carbon price to make it work, as does this outfit here in Maine. It's called Running Tide, and it's made up of basically, some smarty pants people from fishing families, and then a bunch of highly trained engineers from the universities. And what they're trying to do is sink kelp, seaweed, at massive scales, and basically run the carbon cycle backwards. So you plant a whole lot of seaweed way out to sea, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles out to sea, let it float free, and then you do it in a way such that when it gets to the end of its annual cycle, it's absorbed a bunch of carbon dioxide and it sinks down 1,000 meters or more, where it will stay for ideally geological time periods, eventually become oil again, become fossil fuels again. And this is the idea, is to basically create a big sponge for carbon dioxide that's faster than planting trees. Kelp is a fast growing plant. So they're experimenting with it now in the Gulf of Maine, small scale. They've got some really serious venture capital behind them. They've got some oversight from a group of various research institutions, including Woods Hole and Scripps and Stanford and the Smithsonian. And I think they've got more than $10 million behind them. We'll see. It's a fast growing little company. It's a fascinating sort of simple idea. And I've been out on the boat with them. It's very simple. They grow some kelp, they start it in the lab, and then on the wharf, and then they take it out to sea, they put it on a buoy, the buoy will degrade, and then it'll all sink to the bottom. But there are potential knock-on effects. And yeah, that's a big question. Could that interfere with whales? Could it interfere with, you know, foul seashores with a whole bunch of seaweed? So they've got a long way to go, but they're drawing a lot of interest.
Sure. And listeners, we do want to hear your input on, you know, projects like that that are interesting to you, that you think have promise. If you have questions or ideas, you can call us at 800-892-6477 or email us at exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to take a quick break, then talk about more of all this. First, let's hear a message from another listener.
Hi, my name is Jude, and I'm a high school junior from Derry. One project I would love to see is actually something that already exists, the Thrive Act, a comprehensive plan for green economic renewal, which will be introduced in Congress this coming Monday. This legislation ensures that we not just help solve the climate crisis, but do it without leaving anyone behind. Proposals for climate justice, while generally incredibly popular, have caused controversy among fossil fuel workers. But this is changing. The nation's largest coal miners union recently signaled their willingness to transition to a clean economy if they were guaranteed jobs in renewable energy. To me, it's a watershed moment that shows that every citizen has a stake in creating a green and equitable future. This includes communities of color and indigenous communities, which is why the Thrive Act assists those who need it most and allows communities to determine their own priorities. The Thrive Act is a major step towards racial, economic, and environmental justice, and one that makes me, as a young person, optimistic about the future of our country and our world.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Annie Ropeek, filling in for Laura Knoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. But for now, it's Earth Day, and we are here with environmental reporters from around the region as part of our special climate change coverage this week with the New England News Collaborative and NHPR's own By Degrees Project. We had Maine Public's Fred Bever on with us last segment. Thanks for being with us, Fred. And we still have a great group. I have just wanted to say that I've been wanting to do a show like this for like well over a year since we had first tried to launch By Degrees on Earth Day in 2020. You might recall that was the 50th Earth Day. Obviously, COVID got in the way of those plans. But it's been a genuinely inspiring year of working with you all to stay focused on this topic, and I am really glad to have you here. So let's talk now just quickly about some coastal adaptation issues. I mean, again, we could spend a whole show on this, but Eve, I wanted to hear a little bit about how coastal adaptation and plans for rising seas are looking on Cape Cod. Do you see signs of progress there?
Again, it depends on who you ask. Anytime you're talking about coastal adaptation, I think one really interesting conversation that comes into the mix is coastal retreat. The question of at what point is the erosion, is the sea level rise, is the threat of a storm so great, or even the sunny day flooding when it's just high tides and water levels are higher. At what point do we need to start thinking about moving infrastructure like homes, like buildings, like roads, further away from the coast? And on the Cape, that's a really big challenge when we have very little land to play with, and on the islands. And here, there's a lot of interesting work. I think one of the most interesting places where we're seeing this happen is on this road called Surf Drive. It's kind of this picturesque, beautiful road here in Falmouth, where I'm based, actually. And driving down the road, I mean, on a rainy day, it's a wash, it's covered in sand. The water, the ocean water, is coming within, I would call it 15 feet of the road. Mm-hmm. And so the town of Falmouth is looking at a plan to make managed retreat happen in this area. But I have talked to some of the homeowners on this road, and it's an interesting range. A lot of them are second homeowners, and they are of they're wealthy, and they have a lot of money to play with. These are their second homes. But at the same time, their feeling is, I just put 2 years ago, $2 million into this house. This is my retirement plan. What's the plan here? I mean, how am I going to be reimbursed? Where am I going to live if you take this away? There are also homeowners on the road. Like one I spoke with, who's lived in this home since 1980. It's a one-story, very modest home on this road. And for him, I mean, his plan is to die in his home, right? Like that's managed retreat to him is terrifying. But there are plans all up and down the Cape. There's questions about next year. The idea is that there's going to be new floodplain bylaws to make stronger regulations for where new homes can be built in floodplains that will come to all the towns through town meeting. This is really one I could talk for an hour about because it's so complicated to figure out who do we displace or how do we decide what's the right moment to move back before homes are swept away. It's an impossible decision, but it's a really important conversation to be having because erosion is already hitting the Outer Cape really hard. Sea levels rising is already hitting everywhere on the Cape hard. So we've got to be having this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're having a lot of the similar conversation on New Hampshire's seacoast, towns like Hampton and Rye. And you're right, we could spend an hour on it and hopefully we will at some point. I feel like we're doing the news roundup right now. We're just bouncing from topic to topic, but there's so much to talk about. I wanted to go to the issue of trash and landfills now. Patrick, you in Connecticut have been reporting on a lot of chaos that's going on with Connecticut's waste stream. Of course, you know, like energy, our trash system is regionalized pretty much in New England. Tell us about what's going on down there in Connecticut and sort of what the potential solutions you're seeing to this trash problem are.
Yeah, well, trash is an issue that I could talk for hours about. And, you know, if I had a captive audience, I'd love to do that. But I'll briefly run through sort of the core of the issue here in Connecticut right now. And that's we have too much trash and we don't have anywhere to put it. That's kind of what it boils down to. Connecticut right now doesn't landfill municipal waste. So that's, you know, the stuff you toss in a bin or the stuff you take to a transfer station. We've actually for decades been burning a lot of this stuff. But because we've been doing it for decades and we've been using the same plants and the same machines to do that, these plants are old, they're tired, they're breaking down. And a major one here in Hartford, Connecticut, the capital, announced it's actually going to close next year. So that's set off sort of like a mad scramble here in Connecticut where municipalities all across the state are trying to figure out, you know, what the heck are we going to do with all our trash right now? And, you know, one idea is, well, okay, maybe we will throw out less stuff. But the issue has been, well, how do you incentivize that? How do you get that to happen? Obviously, there's, you know, legislation that could happen. But legislatively, it's been kind of mixed here in Connecticut right now. There's a few bills that are aimed at reducing the waste stream of residents here in Connecticut. And they span the gamut of everything from upgrading the state's, it's called the bottle bill. That's the refund for soda cans or glass bottles, moving that from 5 cents up to 10 cents. In an effort to maybe get more clean glass out of curbside bins and kind of cut down on the amount of waste that, you know, towns are responsible for. Our governor says he supports that. The Speaker of the House here supports that. It's his number one environmental priority this year. But then there's other legislative priorities like implementing a program called Pay As You Throw, which would be you basically would have to pay for a trash bag and you kind of be on the hook financially for all the waste you threw away. So if you threw away more, you'd have to pay a little bit more. If you threw away less, the individual customer would have to pay less. That's been poo-pooed big time by the state legislature. So there's a few interesting initiatives that are going on right now. But again, that question is just there. We have all this stuff. We don't know where to put it. And ultimately, if you know the state can't figure out what happens, that's going to get shipped to a landfill, probably not in New England, probably in southern U.S. or in the western U.S. So it's a big issue in Connecticut right now.
Sure. There was a study done in New Hampshire a year or two ago that found that pay-as-you-throw programs where you have to buy, you know, individual trash bags did successfully reduce waste, which I thought was really interesting. I also wanted to read an email we got from a listener. Josh Denton is a former city councilor in Portsmouth and the author of Their Plastics Ban, which is in effect now. Josh writes, "This Earth Day, I'm excited for Portsmouth's outdoor dining. Under our single-use plastic ordinance, every restaurant with outdoor dining on city property should only be using single-use plastic containers, cups, straws that are compostable. Otherwise, the methane released from our landfilled food would be several dozen times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Just a reminder that food waste is the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, that's, I should have mentioned why we are talking about trash when we talk about climate change. John, just quickly, what's going on with landfilling in Vermont?
Oh, boy. Yeah, another hour-long discussion.
Yeah. Give me 10 seconds on that.
Vermont has one mega landfill up in the northern part of the state. It's actually on sort of high ground, and there's concerns about leachate and chemical contaminants going into waterways and then into Lake Memphremagog, which is this spectacular lake that crosses the international border. Most of the pressure on that issue, or a lot of it, has come from Quebec, there's a town up there that draws its water supply from Lake Memphremagog, and they're concerned about PFAS, the everlasting chemicals that you're aware of, Annie, in their water from this landfill. So that's a big issue. And then just quickly, we did, our House of Representatives has expanded our bottle bill to include other containers besides soda and beer. Lastly, I guess we also have a ban on organic waste, to the point about food scraps. You can no longer throw food scraps into your garbage. You have to compost it at home or take it to a composting facility.
Yeah, I want to let Daniela talk about composting for a second, and then Patrick, we can talk with you more about food waste recycling too. Daniela, you've reported on some efforts to get composting to take hold here in New Hampshire. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the city of Lebanon here in the Upper Valley launched a full compost program for the area, and that landfill serves more than 20 towns in the Upper Valley, both in New Hampshire and Vermont. And they had a pilot program over the summer where they diverted more than 1,000 pounds of food waste from the landfill. That was with a pretty small program of like 11 families or so. And to the listeners' email and to what you were saying, Annie, you know, according to an EPA study, about 15 to 20% of the waste stream is food scraps. And then also at the State House this year, and one of the challenges in New Hampshire specifically has been around some of these composting rules that are pretty complicated, and there's a special more in-depth application process to compost meat and dairy that can discourage municipalities and independent companies from starting those composting programs. But there's currently a bill in the House that would set a September 30th, 2021 deadline for adoption of an updated compost rules. And I know some folks are hoping that they can look at this process and perhaps make it easier or more streamlined to be able to compost things like meat and dairy in the state. So that's kind of where we are. And I know there's, if, you know, after doing that story over the summer, you know, we got a couple of emails with folks who are definitely interested in seeing those types of programs exist in their municipalities as well.
Sure thing. So we're running out of time here, and I do just want to mention our biggest source of emissions in New England is transportation, which despite my best efforts, we have run out of time to talk about. I want to play one message we did get from a listener on public transit and transportation when it comes to climate change.
My name is Maddie. I'm 22 years old, and I'm calling from Jaffrey, New Hampshire. I have two dream projects I really want New Hampshire to adopt. I want to see clean, affordable public transit throughout the entire state. This could be done through the Thrive Agenda, a Green New Deal policy on renewable transit, or maybe through Biden's infrastructure plan. New Hampshire's current public transit system, it's basically non-existent in the majority of the state, especially the northern part of the state. This only furthers economic inequality, because if you don't own a car, you can't really get anywhere or get to work. I also want to see New Hampshire towns and cities walkable and bikeable for everyone. Right now, I can't really bike anywhere in my town because I'm worried I'm going to get hit by a car. And I think this is because most of our towns in the state have been built only for car access without prioritizing other forms of transportation like biking, walking, etc. I think these two projects would be really cool for the state because not only would they help fight the climate crisis, which we know we need to do right now, but it would also improve the health of people in our communities by walking, biking, and having less air pollution in the state.
We could spend another whole hour on transportation. I did want to note a couple of things. Eversource, our big utility up here, just joined a national network that's hoping to build a network of EV chargers all throughout the eastern U.S. and Midwest. The Eversource representative I talked to about that said that we could see, you know, long distance EV driving be eminently more possible within a year to 3 years in New England, which is very exciting because, as we've mentioned, transportation is our biggest source of emissions and it's very stagnant. And we've all been reporting a ton on that and will continue to do so. But for now, we'll leave it there. I want to thank all of my fellow reporters for being with us. We've had Patrick Scahill in Connecticut, John Dillon in Vermont, Eve Zuckoff on Cape Cod, Daniela Ali here in New Hampshire, and we had Fred Bever in Maine too. Thank you all so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you.
This show was produced by Exchange producer and news host Jessica Hunt. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Remember, our conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org, and you can see all of our stories from Earth Week at both nnc.news and on NHPR's website on our climate page, nhpr.org/climate. Keep sending in your questions and comments about climate projects you want to see happen in our state. I love hearing from you. You have helped drive so much of this reporting, and I hope you can get outside and enjoy this cold and windy Earth Day in New Hampshire today. I'm Annie Ropeek. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.